Music spirits hits you, it hits you hard, you know. Oh, do she love me? Yes, yes. Do I love her, mama? Yes, yes, mama, she's mine. Well, when she kisses, my heart misses. Come on, baby, she's mine. She's the cloud of happiness, stays on my mind. Gee, I think about her, yeah. She's my baby, I don't mean maybe. Yes, yes, mama, she's mine. I love her. Yes, yes, mama, she's mine. The cloud of happiness stays on my mind. Gee, I think about her, yeah. She's my baby, I don't mean maybe. Yes, yes, mama, she's mine.
Piano Red is recorded in 1974 at the Montreux Jazz Festival, and he'll be with us in just a moment. This afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we'll feature a debate on abortion, recorded earlier today at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. The speakers are Faye Waddleton, the national president of Planned Parenthood, and Jack Wilkie, the national president of Right to Life, Incorporated. Today is the 10th anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision, the Supreme Court decision which legalized abortion. Every Thursday at 3:45, jazz critic Francis Davis hosts Interval, a review of new jazz releases. Today, Francis completes his three-part series on the best jazz recordings of 1982. Well, with me now is Willie Perryman, who is better known as Piano Red, and he's been playing blues and boogie-woogie since the 1920s when he got his start playing rent parties in Georgia. He was born in 1911, 32 miles south of Atlanta. There were nine children in his family, including his brother Rufus, who was also a pianist and became known by the name Speckled Red. Piano Red toured the Black Circuit, and in 1950 he recorded his first record under his name. This single, Rockin' with Red, became a gold record. In 1954, he began an eight-year series of live broadcasts at WOAK in Atlanta, where he became known as Dr. Feelgood. In 1959, Columbia Records released his album Dr. Feelgood, which also went gold. In 1974, he made his first European tour when he was invited to play at the Montreux Jazz Festival. In 1979, the Rolling Stones, who say they had listened to his records when they were young, invited him up on stage to perform with them. Piano Red used to perform regularly at Muhlenbrink's Saloon in Atlanta. Beginning tonight, he'll be playing a couple of concerts in Philadelphia. Tonight, he'll perform at J.C. Dobbs on South Street, and that will begin at 10 o'clock. There will also be a set with Michael Catalano. Saturday night, Piano Red will be at Gottfried Daniels in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And for any more information about the Gottfried Daniels performance, you can call 867-2390, and I'll have all that information again for you a little later. In a few minutes, we'll be hearing a selection from Piano Red's most recent record. Welcome to Fresh Air. It's really terrific to meet you, and I'm glad you're here. Let me ask you how you started to play.
Well, like I said, I started back when I was a boy, like 15, 16, just banging around
walking from house to house and playing for parties. And, well, I wasn't doing much playing no way, but it was good for the people to say he sure can play, you know. I just enjoyed going to the parties because that's where everybody was. And that's the way I got started. I didn't have no kind of teaching and nothing like that. I just picked it up.
You played a lot of rent parties in
the
20s.
Yeah, well, that's what I was playing when I was going to them house parties. They used to call them Saturday night fish fries, you know, and they charged the people at the door, and we'd go there and play. They'd take everything out the room but the piano, and that's the only place those people had to go at the time.
How much would you pay to get in?
10 cents.
And how was the money used? How was the money used to pay the rent?
Huh?
How was the money used that was gathered?
Oh, well, they took the money. I didn't care whether I got no pay or not, you know. I just wanted to play. Well, they might have given me a little something, but they were selling fish, and it was something called White Lightning. They were selling that, so they was making money.
You met a lot of people, I'm sure, when you were doing that. Who are some of the people who were part of that circle then who we might know now?
Back in those days, you know, you might have heard tell them, guys like Eddie Haywood and Bessie Smith and all those people, they was touring, going places then. And they would come into a town and they would be at a theater for not just two or three nights. They'd be there for a week, you know, and people would go see them every night. Well, during that time, that's when we would be playing those house rent parties and things like that, because whenever they would come to town, most all the people, one night or the other, and they'd go to the theater. They had a big theater down in Atlanta called 81 Theater, and people from every direction would come there during that week that they'd be in town, like Butterbean and Susie and Bessie Smith and all those people like that. They had big times. It was just like the people having a big time today because they had somewhere to go.
Before we talk some more, I'd like to play a selection from a recent album. And we're going to hear one of your own songs, and a song that our listeners may know, which is called Right String But the Wrong Yo-Yo. Do you want to tell us about writing this? When did you write it? And
I was going to New York in 1953 to do a session. You had to have four numbers, see? And they called me at the last minute. I was living in Atlanta, and I was on the train coming up. And I didn't have but three. So I was writing the other one on the train, and I looked out the window, and I seen a girl and a boy, and they had a yo-yo, and throwing it on the string, you know. And I got my idea from the Right String But the Wrong Yo-Yo. I wrote it. That was the biggest record I had. Matter of fact, it sold over 2 million records.
Let's hear it from a recent album. The album's called Let Me Play With Your Poodle, and it's on Poodle Records, and this is Piano Red.
Right string, baby, but the wrong yo-yo. Somebody knocking on your door. I passed this morning by the hardware store. I bought a brand new string for my yo-yo. I went on down to the doctor to get the string put on. He turned around, put the string on wrong. No need of knocking on nobody's door. You got the right ring, baby, but the wrong yo-yo. All right, all right. Mama told me, Papa did too. Some of these women gonna be the death of you. Better find out which one you crave, son. Some of these women will take you to your grave. See me coming, put your man outdoors. Ain't
no stranger, I've been here before. No need to knocking on nobody's door. You got the right string, baby, but the wrong yo-yo. Somebody knocking on your door. I passed this morning by the hardware store. Brand new string for my yo-yo. I went on down to the doctor, get the string put on. He turned around, put the string on wrong. No need of knocking on nobody's door. Right string, baby, but the wrong yo-yo.
Piano Red singing one of his best-known songs from an album called Let Me Play With Your Poodle on Poodle Records. And he'll be performing tonight in Philadelphia at J.C. Dobbs on South Street and performing in Bethlehem Saturday night at Godfrey Daniels. In the 1930s, you knew and performed with Willie McTell, the blind guitarist and singer. How did you get together?
Well, Willie McTell, he was older than I was. He knew my brother. Rufus had left out in. They called him Speckle Red. He was already making records. And so Willie had, he walked around different places with his guitar, and he went around to places like drive-ins and all. So he came through where I lived that one afternoon, and he told me, he said, I know you, Red, but you don't know me. Me and your brother is about the same age. And said, why don't you try making some records? I said, well, I'd be glad to. He said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. So I'll get you to write the letter, and we'll write it to this guy that records me in New York. His name is Calloway. And said, we may get you something started. I said, okay, I'll write the letter. I wrote the letter for him, and the man answered him back in a couple of weeks and told him, said that he was going to record him in about 2 weeks in Augusta, and said he knowed my brother Rufus, because Rufus was doing records for their company. So he said that, tell me to get me some material and come on with him. Said they would send us down to Augusta at a radio station. So we did. We went down to Augusta, and what actually happened is it was hot, real hot, the weather was, and we did the numbers all right, but they was catching them at that time, not on tapes, great big thick wax, see, and then they'd take it back and take it off that wax some kind of way. But what actually happened, like I said before, is the wax has got warped, so they couldn't use none of the session. So we didn't get to make any records on that trip.
Did you ever record together again?
No, we never did. I got away from Willie. I started playing at a different places, you know, going from town to town often, you know, just no big deals, but just going, and I got away from Willie, and before we got a chance to play again, he passed.
Did people ever take advantage of him because he was blind?
No, not Willie. He was, and he made a lot of money when money was scarce. They liked him. He had an unusual style like me. I got a unique style. I play like nobody. And he would go around those Pig and Whistles, that's the place where they sell food and all like that. And all the people were real good to him. He made a lot of money. When we wasn't doing no good at all, he was doing fine.
What were you doing during the Depression? Was it hard for you to make money then?
Well, it was bad, but we didn't need much money to get along, so it didn't bother us too much.
What did you do then? Where did you live? Did you travel a lot?
I didn't travel. I hadn't got you know, in the spotlight enough. I was around Atlanta and just around different places, like in playing like in cafes, daytime parties, you know. You could go over to a place like if they had a piano in a cafe, you go over there and start the playing during the day, and in about 40 minutes, the man had a cafe full of people. So he'd be glad to give you something because they were spending money, you know. So we would do those type of things. But like I said, we didn't make no lot of money because, well, we didn't need much to live, so we got by.
Let's listen to another one of your recordings, and this is also an original. It's called Ain't Gonna Be Your Lowdown Dog No More. Do you want to tell us about writing this one?
Well, I tell you what, lots of people had been doing that No More. I just been here. I don't even know who had started it, you know. But ever since I was a young, like I said, playing at those house parties, I used to sing that song. So I went to make records once, and the guy asked me, says, why don't you make that? Says, I believe it'll be good. And it was. It was a big record. But it had been back for years, you know. You don't never know who started. Like those blues singers and things, they would just start a song, you know, singing and all, and next thing you know, people would latch on to it.
Okay. Well, let's hear it. And this is from a 1977 album, Piano Red.
All right. Well, I ain't gonna be your low down dog. I ain't gonna be your low-down dog no more. If you don't want me, woman, why don't you tell me so? Certainly gonna miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. All right. Why don't you tell me so?
Ain't Gonna Be Your Lowdown Dog, and that's recorded on one of Piano Red's recent albums on the Poodle record label. And, gee, you were telling me that you got credit for it because no one really knew who the writer
that's
was.
That's right, yes. We put traditional on it, and nobody called for it, so they give it to me.
Do you know of anyone else who that happened to who had their name on a record and then the real writer, someone claimed to be the real writer at some later point?
Well, once in a while, they says, you know. But they won't, they know that I didn't write it, and then they wasn't going to put my name on it until they found out about it anyway, you see.
You were playing on the circuit for several years. I don't know if you ever, did you ever travel through the Theater Owners Booking Association, TOBA? Huh? Did you ever tour through TOBA?
No.
Because the acronym is TOBA, and I know that it had gotten the nickname of Tough on Black Asses, and I was wondering if you knew what they did to deserve that. You wouldn't know. In the 1950s, you worked at a radio station in Atlanta. I think that was in the 50s.
That's right.
How did that come to be?
I was WAOK. The guy what run the radio station, he used to be a disc jockey himself. And back when I first started making records, his name was Zena Sears. He used to play my records. And finally, they took over a radio station. Well, they got them to run it. A fellow that owned a Coca-Cola company down there. They bought the station and got Zenas them to run it. And he asked me, how would I like to do a show at the station? They put him in charge. I said, what kind of show you want? He said, just be yourself. So I started broadcasting there, and after I broadcast there for a year, I had a studio in my backyard where I rehearsal at, me and the band. So he had me a radio hookup out there. I didn't have to go to the station. I broadcast from home.
You broadcast from your home?
Yeah, that's right.
Did people call you at home during the broadcast?
Huh?
Would people call you to talk with you at home?
Well, they couldn't get me, see, because I was cut off from them at the time. You know, they would be calling, you know.
How did you get the name Dr. Feelgood, which is the name you became known by on the air?
I wrote that song, Dr. Feelgood. And I tell you the way I got it. Broadcasting in the afternoon, I'd tell the people to move in close to the radio. I said, because I'm fixing to change your feeling now. I'm going to make you feel good. I says, all you got to do is concentrate on the music, and I'm going to see to you feeling better when I leave there today. And I got so much mail on the Dr. Feelgood thing, so that's when I wrote the song, Dr. Feelgood.
I don't think we'll be able to hear that in a few minutes. In 1974, I think it was, you toured Europe after performing at the Montreux Jazz Festival. I bet a lot of people in England and some of the other European countries had all of your records, did they?
They do. They know more about my records over there than the people here in the States. they got them all. They stay up to date on those things.
Were you surprised, or did you know that?
I was when I first went over there. But since I started going over there, I go over there twice a year and sometime for as much as 42 days, changing towns every day. So it's just like a superstar over there, those people. They line up to listen to this stuff.
How did you meet the Rolling Stones and perform with them?
I met him at the Montreux Jazz Festival. That was Bill Wyman. He was there. They wasn't playing, but he had came over there to see me. He said they had all my records that I'd been making, and he came over there especially, and he asked me could he play bass with me that night. I told him, sure can. And after that, we were good friends. Whenever they would come to Atlanta or something or come in, I could always do a number with them, and they would always go to the hotels on some names, but they would call me and let me know what name they was on. I'd go by to see them.
Did they listened, I think, to your records when they were young in England. Did you pay much attention to rock and roll? Did you listen to it or play it on your radio show?
Yeah, on the radio show, which they record.
When rock and roll started being played, did you listen to it or play the records?
Well, I tell you what. They said rock and roll. That's nothing but blues and rhythm, you know. That's all it is. We call it blues and rhythm. That's what I am, a blues and rhythm player. I can play blues because I started off playing those house dances, and we had to play slow music because it'd be so many people they couldn't dance, no way, see. So we'd play somewhere they could drag by. But they got that new name out sometime in the 50s about rock and roll, and it's just blues and rhythm. It's nothing. It's a up-tempered. If it's a up-tempered song, then it's rhythm. And if it's slow, it's blues.
Do you think a lot of other blues or rock performers had listened to your records like the Rolling Stones did and had picked up on some of the rhythms?
They probably have. I mean, you know, the Rolling Stones, after they picked up on different things there a while, they acted smart. They went into their own style, and you know this type of stuff they're doing now, you see, it's really different. See?
Do you like it?
Yeah, well, because it is different, you know. And if they had stayed in that same vein, you know, they would have fell behind anyway. They were smart enough to know that.
How have your audiences changed?
I tell you what, I plays at a lot of different places. Now, I plays the whole year round when I want to play. Only time I'll be off is when I want to and I want to take a vacation or something. I'll go in a lot of different places. It's just like the youngsters. What it is, I put on a show, and then it's amazing to them. They say, Red, we don't know what you're doing, but we like it, you know, because of my song. It's different, see? So they likes it anyway. And I've had several kids to come in from outside of these places, and they tell me, Red, play some blues, you know. The kids are beginning to go back into the blues vein. I mean youngsters. They are asking for blues, you know. And like they say, they know that I do something different. They say, we don't know what you're doing, but we like it, you know. I played at a place called The Mill over there in Atlanta for about 3 years after Muhlenbrink closed. And I had a regular crew of kids that came in there every weekend or something like that, especially to listen to Red, you know. They have their own corner. It was a big place anyway. And they enjoyed it, you know. Young kids.
What were you be playing to tonight and Saturday night, some of the songs we've been listening to?
I'll be playing that same stuff you're listening to now. Yeah. I've been playing that same stuff ever since I was playing house dances. And it still goes over good.
Sure does.
See?
I want to thank you very much for talking with us. I've really enjoyed it, and I enjoy your music. And
oh, I
enjoy
talking to
you. Pleasure to meet
you.
Thank you for being here.
It's been great.
Piano Red has been my guest, and he'll be playing, if you'd like to hear him, tonight at J.C. Dobbs on South Street. He's from Georgia, and he doesn't get up here very frequently, so this is a kind of rare chance to hear him in Philadelphia. So that's tonight at J.C. Dobbs on South Street, and there will also be a set by Michael Catalano. Saturday night, Piano Red will be at Godfrey Daniels. That's in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And if you want to go and will need directions to get out there, you can call Godfrey Daniels at 867-2390. That's 867-2390. Let's listen to another selection from the album that we opened with, the Montreux album featuring Piano Red. And we'll hear Corrine Corina.
Stay last night. Oh, Corina, why you stay last night? sun was shining bright. Want you to come on home. Ain't slept a night since you've been gone. Oh! All right, all right. Oh, Corina, that's all right. Corina, that's all right. Come on over, let's make it all right. Corina, where you been so long? Corina, where you been so long? I've been worried ever since you've been gone. You to come on home. Ain't slept a night since you've been gone.
Piano Red from an album on the Black Lion record. The album's called Ain't Gonna Be Your Lowdown Dog No More. And again, Piano Red performs tonight at J.C. Dobbs on South Street with a set by Michael Catalano, and Saturday night at Godfrey Daniels in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And for information about directions or whatever, you can call them at 867-2390. It's 26 minutes to 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're listening to 91 FM. And in about 10 minutes, Francis Davis will be here for this week's edition of Interval, our review of new jazz releases, and today part 3 of his series on the best jazz recordings of 1982. A movie that a lot of people have been waiting to see opened yesterday at the International House in West Philadelphia and will play through Sunday. The film is a documentary called Burden of Dreams, and it was made by filmmaker Les Blank. We'll be hearing an interview with him in just a moment. This film is the documentary of the making of the film Fitzcarraldo, which was made by German filmmaker Werner Herzog. In this film, Herzog tells the story of a 19th century Irishman who lives in South America near the jungle, and his dream is to build an opera house on the Amazon for his idol Caruso to sing in. But in order to raise the money to do this, he has this scheme to harvest rubber trees in a very inaccessible place. And in order to be able to harvest the rubber, he's got to be able to get a boat onto the river there, but he can't get a boat against the current, so what he has to do is drag this boat over a mountain to the other side. And the Irishman uses the labor of many of the Indians there to drag the boat with a pulley over the mountain. It becomes an obsession for this character, and the obsession in this film was compared to Herzog's obsession in the making of the film Fitzcarraldo. And since he really is... He very much wants accuracy in his movie. He really filmed this in the heart of the jungle instead of in part of the jungle that's near a city. And he actually hired many Indians from that part of Latin America to pull a real steamship, was about 350 tons, over this mountain. Les Blank was there to film this, and Burden of Dreams is the documentary about the making of Fitzcarraldo. And it features sequences with Jason Robards and with Mick Jagger, who were in the original movie, but Robards got sick, and the Jagger role was written out afterwards, so they're not in the final film, but they are in the documentary footage. Before we hear an interview with Les Blank, Let's hear an excerpt from the film Burden of Dreams in which Werner Herzog, the director, is talking about what it's like to be in the jungle.
Of course, we are challenging nature itself, and it hits back. It just hits back, that's all, and that's grandiose about it, and we have to accept that it is much stronger than we are. Kinski always says it's full of erotic elements. I don't see it so much erotic, I see it more full of obscenity. It's just, and nature here is vile and base. I wouldn't see anything erotical here. I would see fornication and asphyxiation and choking and fighting for survival and growing and just rotting away. Of course, there's a lot of misery, but it is the same misery that is all around us. The trees here are in misery and the birds are in misery. I don't think they sing, they just screech in pain. It's an unfinished country. It's still prehistorical. The only thing that is lacking is the dinosaurs here. It's like a curse weighing on an entire landscape. And whoever goes too deep into this has his share of that curse. So we are cursed with what we are doing here. It's a land that God, if he exists, has created in anger. It's the only land where creation is unfinished yet. Taking a close look at what's around us, there is some sort of a harmony. It is the harmony of overwhelming and collective murder. And we, in comparison to the articulate vileness and baseness and obscenity of all this jungle, we, in comparison to that enormous articulation, we only sound and look like badly pronounced and half-finished sentences out of a stupid suburban novel, a cheap novel. And we have to become humble in front of this overwhelming misery and overwhelming fornication, overwhelming growth, and overwhelming lack of order. Even the stars up here in the sky look like a mess. There is no harmony in the universe. We have to get acquainted to this idea that there is no real harmony as we have conceived it. But when I say this all full of admiration for the jungle. It is not that I hate it, I love it. I love it very much, but I love it against my better judgment.
Director Werner Herzog, he directed Fitzcarraldo, and the talk that we just heard is an excerpt of the film that's a documentary about the making of Fitzcarraldo. That film is called Burden of Dreams. Burden of Dreams is playing at the International House through Sunday as part of the International Cinema Series, and the International House is located at 3701 Chestnut Street in West Philadelphia. And I'll have a phone number for you in a couple of minutes after we hear the interview. Les Blank and Maureen Gosling are the documentary filmmakers who made Burden of Dreams, and they recently spoke with Michael Goodwin of Pacifica radio station KPFA in Berkeley. Michael Goodwin actually spent a couple of weeks working on the film Burden of Dreams. He even recorded the Werner Herzog monologue that we just heard. He does a radio show about film on KPFA, and when he spoke with Les Blank and Maureen Gosling, he first asked them how they got involved with Herzog and Fitzcarraldo.
Well, I'd met Herzog at the Pacific Film Archives in 1975 and saw Caspar Hauser and was very moved by it and showed him a film called Spend It All that I'd made on the Cajun people in Louisiana. And he was very impressed with that and wanted to see more films, and we got along and I found him interesting. And over the years, I would talk to him when I saw him at the Telluride Film Festival. And then one time I told him I'd like to do a film about him. I thought he'd be a fascinating subject. And he didn't have a lot to say about that. And sometime later, I did do a film about him eating his shoe called Werner Herzog Eats His Shoe, where he was fulfilling a vow he made to Earl Morris that urged him, egged him on to make Gates of Heaven. And I got a call from Herzog sometime after that saying, I'm making this film about pulling a boat through the jungle. Would you like to do a film about the film? And I thought I might, and we met in Berlin and talked about it, and then I somehow agreed to do it.
Did you ever have any reservations or concerns over the fact that this was going to be a dangerous shoot, and Herzog has a reputation of being, if not a careless man, certainly a man who takes great risks in order to achieve great artistic ends?
I was somewhat nervous, yeah, especially when I saw La Soufriere, the film about him filming in an active volcano that was due to go off at any minute, and the whole town of 40,000 had evacuated, seriously believing this volcano was going to blow. And he looked at this as some kind of prank. And so I knew he was a little bit careless with his own life, and I was nervous, yeah.
Now that the film is over, do you feel there were any points at which you were in more danger than you needed to be?
Yes. At the first time we were down in Peru setting up a camp for the actors and crew in northern Peru, in Aguaruna, Indian territory, we were threatened by the Aguarunas, who wanted the camp, you know, not there at all, and they were threatening to attack and kill people. And we were waiting, looking into the bushes, figuring out when they were coming and which direction they would be coming in.
A lot of members of the leftist press were very upset about that incident. And I remember that for about 5 or 6 months, there were stories circulating that Herzog had been violating the human rights of the Indians and all that. What's your line on that? I mean, do you think he was?
Slightly, but not to the degree he was set up to. As it turned out, the man who led the faction of the Aguarunas who were burning down his camp was actually hired by the oil companies to recruit labor, Indian labor, for the oil companies at prices lower than Herzog was offering. And there were incidents reported to the press that Herzog and I was there tracked down, and a lot of them were completely false.
In a way, I think his style and yours can be contrasted interestingly here, because you also have made a career of making films about traditional artists of one kind or another. Most of your films are, of course, about traditional American musicians, although a few of them are also about food. And now there's a big one about a filmmaker. But still, it seems like you can get in and out, and everybody loves you. And nobody ever questions the one-to-one relationship between you and the people you're filming. And yet Herzog, in a similar situation, seemed to get a lot of bad press and stir up a lot of resentment. And I can't help thinking that it's as much a matter of style as anything else.
Well, he was there doing things different from what I usually do. I go in and film what people are normally doing. I don't ask them to do things they don't normally do. But one thing the Indians in the Amazon don't normally do is carry 300-ton steamships through the jungle or live in camps of 400 people when they're used to living in small settlements of only maybe 5 or 6 within a 15-mile. The nearest neighbors would be many miles away.
Les Blank speaking with Michael Goodwin at Pacifica radio station KPFA. Les Blank with Maureen Gosling made the film Burden of Dreams. It's a documentary about the making of the film Fitzcarraldo, which was shot in the jungle near the Amazon. And the film Fitzcarraldo was directed by German director Werner Herzog. Burden of Dreams is currently being shown at the International Cinema, which is located at International House in West Philadelphia, and it's showing tonight through Sunday. For more information, you can call International Cinema at 387-5125, ask for extension 222. That's 387-5125. And the International Cinema is located at 3701 Chestnut Street. And by the way, Fresh Air film critic Bill Van Wert will be reviewing Burden of Dreams tomorrow afternoon at about 3:30 or 3:40, and he'll be reviewing another documentary as well called Not a Love Story, which is a documentary about the pornography industry. So that's coming up tomorrow on Fresh Air. It's 14 minutes to 4 o'clock. This is 91 FM, WUHY FM in Philadelphia. We'll be featuring a debate on abortion at about 4 o'clock with the national president of Planned Parenthood, Faye Waddleton, and the national president of Right to Life, Jack Wilkie. That debate recorded earlier today at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. In a moment, we're going to hear this week's edition of Interval featuring part three of Francis Davis's picks of the best jazz recordings of 1982. I just want to remind you first, if you'd like a copy of his list of the best jazz recordings of 1982 or of rock critic Ken Tucker's list of the best rock records of 1982, just send us a self-addressed stamped envelope at WUHY 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia 19106, and mail that to Fresh Air. Well, this is jazz critic Francis Davis's part three of his series on the best jazz recordings of 1982.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore for now and evermore. That's all,
that's all.
That's Sarah Vaughan from an LP called Crazy and Mixed Up, her newest album on Pablo with pianist Roland Hanna and guitarist Joe Pass. and an almost flawless interpretation of That's All. And I'm Francis Davis. This is Interval, today concluding my survey of 1982's best jazz albums. We have already done reissues and avant-garde LPs. Today, mainstream, the top 10 mainstream albums, and I'm not going to get bogged down in definitions of what the jazz mainstream is at this point, not here anyway. Just consider these LPs that I enjoyed, LPs I think are important for one reason or another, and wanted to include somewhere on my list. I'm pleased to be able to include two albums by vocalists among my choices for the best. The Sarah Vaughan LP we just heard a selection from, in which I think is her most relaxed and most informal session in years, and one of her very best as well. And The Glory of Alberta Hunter, the warmest and most rollicking release yet from the 87-year-old blues and cabaret singer, and that's on Columbia. Also on Columbia, though generations removed, is the self-titled debut LP of Wynton Marsalis, the 21-year-old trumpeter who has made quite a splash this year and last, and whose LP is on most best-of lists, I would imagine, mine certainly included, although I sometimes wonder if all this idolatry might ultimately prove to be a bad thing for Wynton Marsalis. Anyway, I also want to single out Melodic Excursions, an album of duets by tenor saxophonist George Adams and pianist Don Pullen on the Timeless label. Chet Baker and Lee Konitz in concert on Indian Navigation, for the work of both men, but most especially for the playing of altoist Lee Konitz. And another record is Make Me Smile, the Mel Lewis Orchestra plus the Mel Lewis Orchestra plays the combinations and arrangements of Bob Brookmeyer. That's on the Finesse label. Like the George Russell LP I mentioned last week, the Lewis Brookmeyer album reminds us what a wonderful thing a big band is. And it reminds us also that gifted writers and orchestrators will never run out of things to do with a big band. I hope not, anyway. There were many fine releases by pianists in 1982, and among the ones I liked best were Joanne Brachin's trio LP, Special Identity, on the Antilles label, an album that might just as easily go on my avant-garde list, I suppose. Jackie Byard's impulsive and fanciful To Them, To Us on Soul Note, a solo album, and another piano solo album, Kenny Barron at the Piano on Xanadu Records, a definitive statement by a criminally underrated artist, and we'll be hearing a track from it in just a moment. Barron is also a member of Sphere, a quartet also including bassist Buster Williams and two Thelonious Monk alumni, drummer Ben Riley and tenor saxophonist Charlie Rouse. Their first album was a Monk tribute, even the notoriously unsentimental and hard even to flatter, much less please, Thelonious Monk himself might have liked, I think. It was called 4-in-1, and it was released on Electro Musician. Well, here's the Kenny Barron track that I promised you. Kenny Barron playing Monk, not from the Sphere LP, but from his solo record, a great reading of Thelonious Monk's Mysterioso. Thank you. Kenny Barron at the piano, the name of the album, and from it we heard Thelonious Monk's composition, Misterioso. So, there you have it. These last 3 weeks I've run down my choices for the best jazz records and reissues of 1982, and we'll mail you the complete list of 35 albums if you send us a stamped, self-addressed envelope and a note requesting the lists. Send it to Interval, WUHY-FM, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19104. I'm Francis Davis, and next week I'll get back to present tense. We'll try to keep track of what's happening in 1983 as it happens on Interval.
Francis will be back next Thursday with another edition of Interval. And by the way, if you're mailing for those lists, the zip code is 19106. And rock critic Ken Tucker also is making his choices for the best rock records of 1982 available. So just drop us a line with a self-addressed stamped envelope. 4 minutes after four is the time. This is Fresh Air on 91 FM. Today is the 10th anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision, the Supreme Court decision which legalized abortion. Earlier today, the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., held a debate on abortion. We're going to hear that debate now, tape delayed from National Public Radio.
Support for this program is provided by the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.